welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today, later in the show, we will be talking about a whole range of foreign policy and diplomatic issues, especially as it relates to some of these confirmation hearings, and a little bit more as well about the Dylann Root death sentence and a little on the Sessions confirmation situation that is actually still going on right now. But before we can move on, a new survey has come out from Pew, and it measures the attitudes of police officers towards many of the questions raised by the movement for Black Lives. Most of it was predictable, and we'll get to that. But there is one area where the cops and the public largely agree, and that's that the quote-unquote bad apples in police departments are not held accountable. 72%, yes, 72% of police officers believe that officers that consistently do a bad job are not held accountable. The breakdown was that 47% agreed they were not held accountable and 25% strongly agreed that they were not. So there you have it. Straight from the horse's mouth, the worst cops doing the worst things are frequently not held accountable, according to the cops. Unfortunately, the police have not apparently seen the light in general. 67% of police officers believe that the police killings of Black people that have drawn the attention in the past few years were quote-unquote isolated incidents, as opposed to 31% that saw it as a sign of quote-unquote a broader problem. Among the general public, those numbers are essentially reversed. 60% believe it speaks to a broader problem, and 39% think that they are isolated incidents. 92% of officers believe protests demanding accountability for police murder are motivated by long-standing police bias, and 70% say they are scared to do their jobs because they don't want to be held accountable for wrong actions. This is more or less in line with what the police have reflected in their responses to the movement for Black Lives so far and other critiques of policing over the past few years. It also speaks some to why they fail to understand the anger directed against them. In particular, the percentage 70% who say they are doing Ferguson effect type stuff and 83% who say the public don't understand the risk of their job. I mean, it really cuts to the root of the problem. The police feel that violating people's human rights on a regular basis is the only way to quote unquote do their job. The fact that they are refusing to acknowledge the fact that it is possible to police without racially profiling and killing 1,000 people a year means they can't ever really embrace change. They admit their own institution can't discipline the worst actors, yet refuse to acknowledge people have serious reasons for being upset with the police. They're living in a world of their own creation and refuse to believe people could possibly independently evaluate them and make judgments. And while this is not surprising, really, it is a sign that we shouldn't expect the police to change at all. They're going to have to be forced. And Dylann Roof, the perpetrator of the Charleston massacre, has now been sentenced. This happened yesterday afternoon or evening, sentenced to death. And really very few are surprised at this outcome, given that he was charged with first-degree murder and not only admitted he did it, but said he felt compelled to do it and was justified in doing it. Dylann Roof had no remorse. In fact, he even took his own lawyer to court to be able to represent himself purely so that the lawyer did not try to get him life as opposed to death. He actually was facing 33 charges, 17 of which carried the death penalty. So again, it was more or less a foregone conclusion, I think, for most people watching the case. Based on what we know about the death penalty, this won't deter other racist terrorists. The death penalty does not really have a deterrent effect based on the studies we've seen. It also won't bring any extra justice to victims' families, some of whom had stated they preferred Roof get life in prison. And ultimately, this is why many are opposed to the death penalty in this country and why many countries have abolished it. But let's get real here. It was a death sentence either way. Given how heinous the crime he committed was and the large number of Black people in prison, it seems pretty clear to me that eventually someone would have gotten to him, prisoner or guard or both, and killed him. He already was assaulted by one prisoner when allegedly in secure custody. Jurors actually thought the same thing and asked if they could consider whether or not the prison system could keep him safe in their determination of sentence. The reality is Dylann Roof is a racist terrorist. So, you know, beyond general principles, I'm not really that upset about the death penalty, and I certainly won't be crying any tears when they stick the needle in his arm. President Obama returned to his role as lecturer-in-chief last night as he gave his farewell speech. Honestly, the substance of the speech is not all that important for me to recap for you here. I mean, he basically just recapitulated the things he felt he had done well, said racism and inequality are ripping the country apart, made some general statements about national unity, we're all Americans, that kind of thing, and then implored people to organize and run for office. And honestly, fell a little flat for me. It was classic Obama and really a total deflection away from any of his own mistakes. He essentially admonished people towards the end there for not voting or not being involved in enough. However, he refused to admonish himself for building the largest organizing army in history in 2008, then promptly demobilizing it after he was elected, and then using his political capital principally to push a healthcare plan developed by the hard right Heritage Foundation. He also failed to mention how he campaigned on the Employee Free Choice Act, then promptly forgot about it once he hit 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. So he complains about income inequality, and sure, much to complain out there, but he didn't use his political capital to give workers new rights to help them organize against it, even when Democrats control both houses of Congress and the presidency. I could go on and on, but that isn't really the point. The point is Obama gets far too much credit for being a progressive champion than he should. He gets a pass on foreign policy stances that, had he been a Republican, would have gotten him roasted by most Democrats. Not to mention the alt-right, Donald Trump, Occupy Wall Street, and Black Lives Matter all emerged during his own presidency. So rather than bringing people together, it seems Obama's center-right conciliatory posture only drove people further apart. So Donald Trump had his first press conference in several months today. I mean, it went pretty much exactly how you would expect it would. Let's take a little bit of a listen.
Like, can you give us a question?
Don't be
You're
rude.
Attacking us. Can you give us a question?
Don't be rude.
Can you
no,
give
I'm
us a question?
I'm not going to give you a question.
Can you stay categorical?
You are fake news.
Yep. There you go. Basically, the bulk of the thing was about the Russia situation, which, as it's becoming increasingly clear, is not really about Russia's role in U.S. elections. As we've noted on this show so many times, there's so many countries trying to influence U.S. politics all the time. We have to really look at this a little more carefully. The circulation and publishing of a report of, you know, shocking but completely unsubstantiated claims about Donald Trump's personal life is clearly political. A raft of claims by someone who is paid to find dirt that don't have any sort of information corroborating them is not news. That major media outlets would talk about it without any ability to verify them is troubling. Also, these organizations have had access to this information for months and failed to be able to ascertain its truthfulness. That includes the New York Times and BuzzFeed, for instance. However, a drumbeat of former intelligence officials, war hawk senators, and anonymous sources quoted in the newspapers from the quote-unquote intelligence community elevated it to the status of essentially 100% true, noting that it had been included in the intelligence report given to Trump and Obama, although the Trump camp denies that element of it. We've said it before on this show, the main thrust of the Russian allegation seems clearly to be to make it impossible for any U.S. president to propose a major change in course as it concerns U.S.-Russia relations. After the fall of the Soviet Union, the U.S. promised that it would not push NATO closer to Russia, recognizing that in Russia, one of the key fears is this fear of U.S. encirclement and attempted regime change. But the U.S. broke that promise and has pushed NATO as close to the Russian border as they possibly have been without being able to start an immediate war. And the anti-Russian neocons who love that kind of stuff all supported Hillary Clinton, hated Donald Trump, and then when Trump actually wins the campaign, they start a massive campaign via anonymous sourcing and very thinly sourced reports to make it appear that Trump could not have won the election, or that, maybe even better, Hillary Clinton could not have lost without the help of Russia, despite essentially no evidence being put forward to support this. It isn't that it can't be true. It's just that the sourcing is so thin it can't support such a rock-solid assertion as what we're seeing from the media and from many Democrats right now. Why would you push forward so recklessly on something without evidence? Well, it's because clearly there's another agenda, and that agenda, again, is to limit the options of the incoming administration vis-a-vis Russia. There are a huge range of super legitimate and 100% true information that could be used to discredit Trump or make him look bad or just generally dirty him up, from his statements about just about every ethnic group and women overall to his extensive business deals and terrible stated policies, from his cabinet having a racist and being packed full of climate change deniers to the fact that a good number of the named cabinet nominees are plutocrats and generals with unsavory records. You could highlight the intensity of his hostility to China and the potential with war with that country, or his reckless statements on nuclear weapons. Yet, The thing they, and that being, I guess, everyone in the Senate apparently, and most major news media, are harping on are thinly sourced, potentially false claims about Russia. And when I say potentially false, it's worth noting I am not the one asserting that. The intelligence community's own definition in their own declassified document about Russia says that they have high confidence. Now, the high confidence note is a little note at the bottom about what that means. And in the note, it says that high confidence means that this is what they think is true, but it could not be true. So this is the intelligence community are telling you in front of your own eyes, it might not be true. Yet literally the entire media and political establishment are treating it as if it's 100% true. Clearly, there's another agenda at work, and it's pretty clear what it is. And those were today's talking points, and you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movement shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And we are joined to continue our conversation with the star of the By Any Means Necessary Facebook page, as well as the executive vice president of the National Lawyers Guild, Rhea Thompson. Rhea, thank you so much for joining the show.
Hi, how are you today, Eugene?
Oh, I'm doing very well, thank you.
Good. And just by the way, it's Thompson, Washington. You know, I got married and I got to live for my hyphen, so.
No, I hear that. I hear that. Thompson, Washington. I'll have to make sure my production team is more on top of looking at what people's names are. But let's just go ahead and get right into it. I want to start with the Dylann Roof thing. I mean, I think it was what most people expected, as you probably heard. I mean, I'm pretty whatever. I mean, it is what it is.
Yeah.
I'm not crying tears for him. I mean, what are your thoughts on the overall issue of him getting the death penalty and any other comments you just want to make about how the trial went down?
So the trial was, it wasn't as much of a spectacle as it could have been. The most exciting part was when Mr. Roof wanted to represent himself, I would say. Essentially, what, you know, him getting the death penalty is what most people would have expected. As an abolitionist who believes that we need to abolish prisons as a method of punishment to begin with, I'm wholeheartedly and emphatically opposed to the death penalty as method of deterring crime or deterring murder or as a punishment for people who have committed those crimes. We are not going to be healed by his death. We're not good. It's not going to, like, do anything. And I think that it's really a tepid way to assuage the people who have been impacted by racism and white supremacy through the criminal justice system to say, well, here's one white supremacist that we can clearly and plainly identify, and we'll kill him so you can feel better. That's problematic for me. I don't support the state killing anyone, murdering anyone, taking any life, because if we allow them to have those kinds of powers, then what will come next?
Well, certainly, and with our incoming administration, I think that's very worth considering. You know, one other issue I wanted to raise in relationship to the Dylann Roof thing as well, the way it played out, too, with his attorney, I think that was the most exciting thing. And, you know, allegedly they were saying he was, you know, he was trying to say that I'm not crazy. The attorney was trying to say that he was, that not that he was crazy, but that he wasn't in sort of his own mind or whatever. And I guess the judge determined that it was okay. Now in the sort of appeal phase, is it up to Roof now to potentially appeal his sentence, or could some third party come in sort of subsequently and maybe try to change things?
It's going to be up to Roof. I don't think that there is going to, I mean, there may be third parties like the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty who might try to come in and help on his behalf. I don't know that that's necessarily what he wants. I think personally that Dylann Roof deserves to die a natural death. He deserves to have the opportunity to be penitent, which is what the idea behind jail's words is, to give people an idea, opportunity to think about his crimes. And I don't think that we should be looking as a way to try to get retribution, because we're never going to get that feeling back. We'll never get those people's lives back. We'll never get that moment back. All we will have is another murder for a murder, and no one will feel better after it. Even the families of the people who were killed, the victims, don't even want, some of them are not interested in the death penalty being the method of punishment for him. So I think we really need to think about, as a country, that how barbaric and uncivilized and antiquated the death penalty is as a method of punishment, and that we really need to think about death by execution being premeditated murder by the state and what that means about the world that we want to live in.
Well, and switching gears here quickly, the New York Times editorial on the Jeff Sessions nomination and some things I've seen from many other people, a lot of people feel that everyone, but Democrats especially, essentially kind of gave Sessions a pass and didn't really get that deeply into a lot of the issues around that. And as both an attorney and someone representing the National Lawyers Guild, how do you feel about how they went about the Sessions situation?
I was just speaking about this earlier. I'm really disappointed with the way that the Democrats didn't hold Sessions accountable for some of the statements that he made. It was like, well, how do you feel about Roe versus Wade? Oh, it's the law of the land, so it's okay. I would have wanted them to push back more, to ask more questions about how we're going to follow up with him and what is his ideas of making changes to these departments. What is he going to do with the Office of Civil Rights? All of these things that he's going to have a direct impact on that can affect our daily lives, and we just have to trust, based on the flimsy questioning of Democrats, who should have really held his feet to the fire a little bit more, and I'm really disappointed that they didn't.
Yeah, and you know, one of the issues that I thought that they really whiffed on was the consent decree thing. I mean, he spoke against consent decrees. He had that Republican set him up with the easy sort of, it's just a few bad apples question, but in fact, the reports from the Justice Department proved the exact opposite of that, and no one brought that up.
Right. So I feel like I think that people were so hyped and into the sensation of what was happening at the moment, of all of the people who were interrupting or disrupting and showing their, you know, opposition to Sessions, that the Democrats didn't use the opportunity that they had wisely. I think the one that did the most would be Al Franken. He was very solid. I think he, you know, called him to task about some of the questionable spots in his resume that we could, in Sessions' resume, that might need to be revisited, and the way that he characterized himself as, you know, being a champion for civil rights. I think that Al Franken was the person who held him the most accountable, and I wish more Democrats that followed his Senator Franken's lead.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that is indeed the case. And I wonder, sort of inside the ranks of the National Lawyers Guild, obviously lawyers who are always on the front line of all social justice struggles, I mean, what's sort of the scuttlebutt there about what folks are expecting under a Trump presidency?
Well, I mean, we're trying to get to inauguration, to be honest with you, Eugene.
I hear you.
So we have J20 coming up, and that weekend, next weekend, there's going to be so many actions that are happening. I mean, the actions have really started today. There's one for Oscar Lopez down at the White House with trying to get President Obama to pardon him. We have Know Your Rights trainings and legal observer trainings coming up that will be trying to make sure that we can engage all of the people. There's a number of attorneys, legal workers, activists who are going to be coming to D.C. to protest and to help protect people who are exercising their First Amendment right and who are advocating for social change by getting out in the streets. And so what our focus has really been is making sure that we have enough attorneys, legal observers, activists to be on the jail lines, to make sure that we have the jail support lines and bail support lines, and making sure we can follow people through the system if they are arrested, making sure that we can make sure that the police allow people to exercise their First Amendment rights freely without fear of being imprisoned just for being in the street. So really what we're doing is trying to make sure that what happens this next weekend is that everybody stays safe and has an opportunity to get their point across.
Mm-hmm. Well, anyone who's ever been to a protest before knows that the National Lawyers Guild and their green hats do a great job of that. So please somehow get out there, follow them, support them, do whatever you can if you are listening. We are going to take a break. We're going to come back with more here on By Any Means Necessary. Big thanks to Rhea Thompson Washington, who you just heard, the Executive Vice President of the National Lawyers Guild. And after the break, we will be back with more on all the news that is fit to talk about here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about the world of, well, I don't know, war and peace, foreign policy, diplomacy, all of that, especially given that, as we know, some of that has been coming up at the confirmation extravaganza happening in front of the Senate on today. And we are joined for this conversation by David Swanson, the author, activist, and journalist, and radio host, and Rania Kolick, who is also a journalist, and both of whom are good friends of the show. Thank you both for joining again.
Great to be here.
Thanks for having me on.
So, David, I'll start with you here. One piece of very interesting news I saw this morning that, you know, is somewhat flying under the radar. NBC News reporting that Chelsea Manning is on Obama's short list of commutations. I mean, how important is that fact?
You're in a small minority that finds that interesting or anything interesting other than a particular other story, I would say, and I appreciate that. Whether it's serious, whether it's, you know, nonsense put out by the president, I don't know, but it doesn't hurt to flood the president. And apparently they've shut down the White House phone line, but call the Justice Department phone line. We've got a site, if you go to rootsaction.org, you can email the president, you can tweet at POTUS, and you can make a phone call and demand that Chelsea Manning be free. You know, she doesn't have to be pardoned. He can commute her sentence to time served, torture inflicted, and that's enough. And obviously more than enough, she should have been rewarded, not punished, based on the campaign promises of a certain Barack Obama 8 years ago. There is obviously a chance that if he's going to free any decent whistleblowers who've helped us, she is the most likely, because the most well-known and the most punishment already inflicted. So, you know, call, tweet, email, do everything you can right now, because NBC also said a decision might happen today.
Wow. Well, that's certainly quite interesting. And you know, Rania, as someone who works as a journalist, I've always felt that this is so strange to me. I mean, you get all these editorials coming out from all these people. Not one major news source has come out and said that Chelsea Manning should be freed, even though the information that she released is consistently used from WikiLeaks, from New York Times, Washington Post, The Guardian. All of them are consistently mining this to help back up stories that they're writing. And yet it seems like the journalistic establishment, by and large, in the United States has not rallied to her defense.
Absolutely. And that's how it's been since the start, since we knew Chelsea Manning was the one who leaked all of this really important information. And, you know, you've got various journalistic outlets that have, you know, they've gotten a lot of clicks and they've been able to produce a lot of journalism because of these leaks. But when it comes down to it, you know, the establishment media in this country loves Obama, loves the Obama administration. And generally speaking, they agree with the government when it comes to this kind of stuff. They toe the government line. I mean, I recall the Washington Post, I think it was, actually writing an editorial saying that they want Edward Snowden to be prosecuted. Despite the fact they actually won like a Pulitzer for based on the things that Edward Snowden leaked to them.
Right.
So, yeah, there's no, when it comes to the media generally, I mean, there is a real like distaste and disgust for people who leak classified information across the board. Unfortunately, they just adopted the view of the government because a lot of them are government mouthpieces.
I think there is a lot of truth to that. And before we switch gears, I'm glad you raised the Edward Snowden thing. And, you know, David, there was the whole speech with Obama last night on his legacy. And one piece of his legacy that I feel like certainly deserves more scrutiny and will not is that he was the toughest president in history on whistleblowers, despite the fact that he came in, as you had alluded to earlier, with the exact opposite line.
Yeah, well, I mean, don't overlook the hope and change. And yes, we can. He's promising. I mean, this is exciting stuff, and people are just sort of ignoring it. No, I avoided his speech because it was full of nonsense. But he had some good campaign promises, and he only kept the bad ones. You know, he only kept escalate Afghanistan and send missiles into Pakistan and so forth. All the good ones just went by the boards, you know, in the first year, and he became someone who had government employees obliged to squeal on each other for any sort of suspicious activities, and who created a real crackdown on passing information to journalists. So people's sources just dried up who were previously available because of this fear of these prosecutions and these lives ruined. Whistleblowers like Thomas Drake and Jeffrey Sterling, who's now in prison, and the ones people know about, Chelsea Manning and Edward Snowden. This crackdown on whistleblowers has been intense and has created incredible secrecy and incredible distrust and a growing public belief that there should be incredible government secrecy and we should just accept what the government tells us on faith and so forth. And this has been the work of this supposed constitutional lawyer who was going to bring the most transparent administration in history.
Yeah, no, great points. And you know, it makes me wonder about another issue that is sort of out here contemporarily in terms of the effect of this. And Rania, I'll ask you to start with you on this question. I mean, you know, in terms of even just like how things get reported now, I mean, I was sort of shocked that yesterday, I wasn't really shocked, I was upset, I guess. You know, so you get this really just shocking, unsubstantiated report about Donald Trump's personal life and like, you know, whatever. I get like why you would have some reporting on that. But then the other thing that came out yesterday was this massive article in The Intercept about huge war crimes committed by SEAL Team 6 over a number of different years in multiple different countries, which seemed to me to actually be huge news and no one else touching it, picking up on it, trying to report on it. And so here we are in a situation where it's almost like we've become desensitized to some degree, or maybe even forcibly desensitized to a lot of these sort of crucial stories that relate to the national security establishment in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah, I would agree with what you just said. We've become desensitized, but I think it's also what the media chooses to highlight and give attention to. And everything right now is about Trump and about, you know, unsubstantiated claims and the Russia, you know, hacking into our elections, even though there's like no evidence. And it's really unfortunate. It's like this is all anybody cares or the media cares about or cares to talk about is just fake news. I mean, the same media who brought us the controversy about fake news is just constantly amplifying fake news, even just to report that it's fake. Meanwhile, actual real things are happening. Like people are suffering. There's war crimes taking place. And even domestically, right now, you've got a Republican Congress that is prepared to cut all kinds of really important programs. And instead of devoting a lot of time to that, we're talking about nonsense and just complete BS. I mean, it is really disillusioning to watch. It really feels like, you know, I really hope this isn't how the Trump presidency goes, where it's just all about the theatrics and reporting on Trump's, you know, like behavior as opposed to, you know, or his like rhetoric as opposed to talking about what's actually happening on the ground and what people are dealing with. And, you know, the government like corruption that's taking place. I'm really, really concerned it's just all going to be, you know, hey, let's oppose Trump and by like reporting on how awful Russia is. It's very confusing.
Mm-hmm. No, I think it's a good point. And David, I want to get your thoughts on this story because I thought that was another very relevant issue in the Obama administration is how he doubled down on sort of the SOCOM, JSOC, dark operators type of role, which was coming in towards the Bush, into Bush administration and almost sort of like this trade-off, like, you know, we're not going to quote unquote have boots on the ground, but we'll unleash these, you know, SEAL teams, Delta Force, whatever around the world. And this seemed like a very relevant story for that strategy that didn't look that good on his side.
An incredibly important story that goes to the claim that you can have a war without torture, a war without atrocities, a clean Geneva conventionized war. It's never existed in the history of the world and never will. We had an event in Washington at the National Press Club yesterday, well covered by the press outside of the United States, but as far as I know, not a word within, demanding that President Obama or Senator Feinstein or anybody else release the torture report. And I made comparisons to that story about SEAL Team 6, but then, you know, it wasn't covered, not within the United States. You can go watch the video at davidswanson.org. But you have now a situation where war has been accepted and hostility toward Russia has been accepted by all good Democratic partisans, and you have someone coming into office in Donald Trump who is impeachable on day one for financial conflicts of interest among numerous other high crimes and misdemeanors, and all the Democrats are going to want to do is go after this Russia nonsense, which is going to blow up on their face, unless, as I predicted last week, Trump gives them a sex scandal, and now we already have that, although it may be a lot of nonsense. Although I had the misfortune of just watching CNN for 5 minutes, and you've got them reporting that Russia claims all the things that are in this, you know, nonsense document, unverified, even though Russia denies it. And they never mention that Russia denies it. Is over and over again, Russia claims to have control over Trump, and at the same time denouncing BuzzFeed or whatever it was for irresponsibly publishing the document. How do people watch this crap?
You know, I want to add one thing to that, to what David just said, and to your other, to your question that you mentioned with the kind of shadow wars that Obama has, you know, kind of codified as now, you know, that this is what America does now, is we have all these shadow wars that nobody really knows we're involved with or cares. It's actually, I think, empowered the Pentagon to an extreme degree. The reason I say that is because, you know, there was another story that didn't get covered, and it was by Gareth Porter in Truthdig last week. And it was on how, you know, a few months ago when the U.S. bombed and killed like 60 or so Syrian army soldiers, I think, and you know, claimed it was, they thought it was ISIS, how that was in fact the Pentagon trying to sabotage the Obama administration's attempt at like a ceasefire with Russia. And that's a huge story, I think, because if you've, you know, you've got the Pentagon military apparatus literally undermining the commander in chief, like that's a big deal. And that wasn't covered anywhere. And so I don't know. I mean, that's, you're basically like, that means that the civilian leadership of the military doesn't have as much power as they're supposed to over the military. That's really dangerous. New territory that you're moving into. And that seems like a relevant thing to also be talking about, especially when, you know, you've got all these shadow wars taking place that nobody knows about. It's like almost like an autonomous system on its own that no one has control over. And that, I don't know. I think that's a scary situation for down the line.
No, absolutely. I mean, and I think Glenn Greenwald has an article out today with sort of that sort of general thrust as well, that really this is sort of like a deep state strike back here. And it's people who, you know, like no one knows who these people are, or what they're doing. And, you know, one thing that also I feel like is being heavily underplayed in this whole thing is that Betsy DeVos's brother is Eric Prince. I mean, like the number one dark operator in the history of dark operators, as it goes, who now is, for people who may be curious what he's doing post-Blackwater, working in Africa, helping do quote-unquote security for Chinese and other companies looking to do business in different countries. But I think that's a relevant question that Rania raises too, David, that I think I want to stick with for a second, is this whole idea. I mean, here you have all these military people who are being brought into the cabinet. I mean, we're having what, I don't know if it's unprecedented, but unprecedentedly public intelligence, almost rogue intelligence. I mean, who is leaking all this? It's classified information to the Washington Post and the New York Times. Is it authorized by Obama? Is it authorized by the head of the CIA? Is it rogue networks like a Track 2 tile network that existed in the 60s? I mean, it does seem like quite a concerning situation.
Very much so, and I agree with everything both of you have said. And bringing in these military generals for cabinet positions, including Mattis for the Pentagon, illegally, you know, unless they get a waiver because he's not been out of the military a sufficient number of years, is quite dangerous. There goes civilian control of the military if it exists now. You know, I think Gareth Porter is right on in his analysis of what's happened in Syria. The military has been trying to push wars privately and publicly on President Obama through the course of his presidency. Sometimes he's welcomed them, sometimes he's tried to resist them, but you've had generals out there demanding how many troops should go to Afghanistan, and President Obama, you know, negotiating publicly with the generals how many troops he would send. And I think your point, Eugene, about special ops is incredibly important. If SEAL Team 6, you know, the model of special ops is, we see now, is clearly a criminal operation in every sense, and you have these special ops, so-called special, you know, there are more of them than the entire militaries of most nations, in two-thirds of the countries on Earth, you know, and the likelihood of Donald Trump bringing those under control is, you know, is very, very slim. And you now have this idea being pushed by senators from both parties in these hearings and by, you know, talking heads on CNN, that any U.S. president and any cabinet member must believe the so-called intelligence, so-called community on faith, or it will endanger the universe and Tinkerbell's light will go out. You know, this is This is incredibly frightening to me. Why in the hell should you believe this stuff on faith? Every former CIA employee who will talk to me doesn't believe a word of it, you know, and tells you the whole damn thing was political and corrupt and nepotism up to your neck. You know, so I find the subservience of the media and the Congress members more disturbing even than what's, you know, leaking out of the CIA.
Yeah, no, I think that's certainly a very good point. And I think, Rania, it does really raise this issue. I mean, it just sort of seems like it must be politically motivated on the part of the press. I mean, I don't know. Maybe they're afraid that they won't get the clicks if someone leaks, puts it out and they don't put it out. But I mean, it's just it doesn't matter how unsubstantiated these claims are. It doesn't really matter how long the history has been of the CIA of using journalists as vectors of disinformation. I mean, it just sort of is just like crazy to me that the way, I mean, especially, you know, out in Congress, like the things that people are saying, I mean, in Congress, they're quoting from this unsubstantiated report as if it is 100% true and saying, oh, well, they won't even really investigate it, the FBI, that is. And it's just one of those, I mean, it's really, I mean, I don't even know what to say listening to some of these hearings. I mean, Jeff Sessions, it's the attorney general, and they're asking him, I mean, Amy Klobuchar was talking about like trips to Ukraine that she had taken and what, like, are you kidding me right now?
Yeah, it's really absurd. And I'm so disgusted with Democrats right now. It's like, this is your opposition to Trump. This, like, to fearmonger and want to go to war with Russia. That's your opposition to Trump. Like, what the hell is going on? I feel like Trump is going to have a second presidency because of the behavior here. And I feel like at the end of the day, like with Jeff Sessions, especially like yesterday, I was watching the hearings. And all of these senators are just falling all over, like all over themselves, trying to compliment him. Like even the Democrats, like are like, yeah, like he's an old friend or something. It's like, no, like you guys get it together. I mean, it just shows that at the end of the day, like there are maybe, I mean, at the end of the day, everybody's just like willing to, you know, bow down to like wherever power lies, I suppose.
I think you're right.
It's really, I know, it's really, really concerning. And I feel like we're going to end up going to war with Russia. Like, I feel like that's where things are headed when you've got, you know, all of these senators from both sides of the aisle, like visiting all of these border countries that border Russia and saying like, you know, and just like making provocative statements. And then you've got like the U.S. buildup of like NATO troops around Russia and special operations forces. I'm just, and like, nobody cares. Again, like nobody cares. The media is just kind of sitting back and justifying it. I was reading all these different media reports on that troop buildup, and I believe they were just quoting this general being like, yeah, this is how we maintain peace. It's insane.
It's through the looking glass. Well, you know, David, let me slightly switch gears again here to speak to some other war and peace issues. Another overlooked story. John Kerry did his farewell speech at the State Department. One of the things that came up, of course, that he talked about was the situation in Syria. And it was interesting. He noted in the thing, and I got this from Stop the War in the UK, put out a note about this morning, that what made them change course, Obama, that is, and seek the congressional approval for war was how Cameron had gotten refused in Parliament to go to war to Syria, which, as you know quite well, came after a lot of campaigning by Stop the War in the UK. I mean, they really made a big intervention there. And I mean, that seemed very notable to me because people always say, well, what a protest accomplished. You never do anything. They do whatever they want anyway. And here we go right here, John Kerry putting it out there like, yeah, the whole reason we didn't do this is what happened in the UK. And obviously, you know, we can go one step further and tie that to anti-war campaigners. I mean, pretty interesting story, I thought.
Yeah, I agree. And President Obama has gone further and credited not just the vote in Parliament, but the incredible public opposition in the United States, which is, you know, is not him pretending to be Democratic and representative. That is the last thing they ever want to admit, is that they're influenced by public opinion. They all claim to ignore opinion polls and be above giving a damn. And yet he admitted in that very lengthy U.S. magazine profile in which he's presented as this great force of peace against the warmongers, that he had made the decision for a massive bombing campaign of Syria. You'll recall Raytheon's stock was the highest it's ever been in history, and he had committed to Senators McCain and Graham and the rest of the warmongers, and every media outlet and you know, and every stock owner on Wall Street knew it was going to happen, and he reversed the decision. And he gives a number of reasons, but yes, central is the vote in Parliament, which was a direct response to public pressure globally and in the UK, and Stop the War Coalition and the other anti-war groups, but also U.S. pressure. You had Congress members openly saying, I don't want to be that jerk who votes for another Iraq. You know, and so people, peace activists who beat themselves over the head over and over again saying, we opposed the war in Iraq and it happened anyway and we're useless. No. That 10 years of opposing the war in Iraq that kept it smaller than it would have been and made it illegal rather than a policy choice like torture now is, all of that built to the point where you could tell Congress members, don't be that jerk who votes for another Iraq. And they didn't want to do it. They didn't want to vote for a major U.S. escalation in Syria on the basis of claims about weapons of mass destruction without evidence. It was just too similar to Iraq, which had become a curse, which prevented, twice prevented, Hillary Clinton from becoming president. You know, so there was, incredible strength shown by the activist community, which, you know, as usual, in that moment, you know, seized defeat from the jaws of victory and said, oh, we had nothing to do with it. Obama didn't ever really want that war, and Raytheon didn't really want any money this week, and the Russians somehow did it. You know, peace activists were blaming the Russians way before the Democrats. So, you know, we ought to, and it was a very partial victory, and people were even more against arming and sending in fighters and with weapons and trainers and advisors than they were against the bombing. But it was a victory that showed the potential if we would know our strength and act on it more often.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, we are going to take a break here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are continuing our conversation about many of the war and peace, foreign policy, diplomacy issues that are confronting the United States and the world as we move on. And we continue to be joined by David Swanson, the author, activist, journalist, and radio host, and Rania Kolick, also a journalist with many different outlets, both frequent appearance on this show, which we appreciate. And Rania, I want to start with you here too, because one other issue to me, this is like an issue that drives me crazy right now about what's going on in Syria and what's going on in Iraq, is this whole no boots on the ground fiction. I mean, like, every politician now is like, well, we need to deal with Syria, but we need to deal with Iraq, we need to do this, but we don't need any boots on the ground. But there's like 5,000 people in Iraq, God only knows how many in Syria. Obviously, the U.S. is playing a major role. I mean, like, what does it take for people to just start saying, like, clearly we have boots on the ground?
Yeah, it's really stunning. It's like, okay, so like a couple thousand boots on the ground isn't really boots on the ground. Like, they're just all advisors or something. We are at war in both of those countries. We are on the, like, I should say weeks, I'm not there, but like the U.S., the military is on the ground in both Syria and Iraq. And they might be, some of them might be in advisory roles, but regardless, there are people actually fighting too. And even regardless of that, we are like fueling a war. I mean, that's what we have to understand here. Two wars that we created too. And I think that's what people don't grasp. I think a lot of what happens in Iraq and Syria is so confusing to the general public and even people who like read about what's going on, because the media coverage of these places is really confusing. People don't really know what's going on. It's just like, seems like this really confusing mess where like, are we fighting ISIS? I guess maybe. Or are we fighting like the Syrian government? Like, it doesn't make sense. So it's something that's like just easy to forget about and not consider like the U.S. being at war. And also there's not really, at this point, there's not really any consequences for the U.S. that are tangible at the moment, because like you don't have people being killed, like soldiers being killed every day. And so until at some point, I think, you know, at some point there's going to be blowback from what we've done in Iraq and Syria, particularly right now, what we've done in Syria for the past 5 years, because we've like empowered extremists, we've empowered Al-Qaeda groups in Syria. And now the Syrian government is winning. And I think there's going to be blowback from that. And I've mentioned this to you on the show before, that we're going to see more of that. And I think since we talked, there was like a couple attacks in Europe and Turkey. And I think at some point there's going to be attacks like that in the U.S. And people are just going to be so confused as to why. And I think that what's going to happen, especially under the Trump administration, is you're going to have a change and a shift. And we're already seeing it from being like, we got to go into Syria to take down the government and fight ISIS, to we got to go into Syria to fight Al-Qaeda, which we basically helped, you know, facilitate in Syria. And so there's a real chance that we could actually end up putting even more, and we probably will be putting more U.S. troops on the ground in these places.
There is kind of an eerie thing on this show where people predict things happening. I'm pretty sure someone made a prediction like right before those cops got killed in Dallas that was like somewhat similar. I think we had the Pulse nightclub shooting. Someone was predicting things are going to happen. So I don't really know like what's going on here, but this is like a really bizarre like magic eight ball.
There's also a chance I could like win the lottery or something. I don't know. Let's see if that comes true. I'll take some good predictions. Man. But for real, I mean, it's a great business model if you think about it. I mean, you facilitate the empower the rise of Al-Qaeda in Syria, and you know, under the cover of like trying, you know, we're going to take down the government, and when that doesn't work, you keep the war going by saying, well, now we got to go and fight Al-Qaeda. It's like the best business model ever.
Yeah, no, I think it's a good point. It's a good point. And you know, David, I'm curious what you think about this boots on the ground piece as well, because I think Rania referenced this. I mean, they're all referred to as trainers, but then when you really look up what they're actually doing, I mean, most of them are playing like key roles, artillery, aircraft spotting. Like they could not have these offensives, at least in Iraq, that they are having without the U.S. military.
There's no question. But let me go ahead and predict that Chelsea Manning will be free just in case
it,
you know, there's some sort of magic here. But you know, the Saudis could not be bombing families in Yemen without the U.S. military actively engaged in the targeting, in the refueling of the airplanes midair and so forth. The United States has 8,000 troops still on the ground in Afghanistan. Combined with mercenaries and NATO troops and so-called contractors, you got over 40,000 people still occupying a foreign country in Afghanistan over 15 years after overthrowing the government that they went in to overthrow. And, you know, it gets worse every year, and they predict success around the corner every year and just rolls on and on. And same with Syria and Iraq. These are ongoing catastrophes made worse all the time by direct U.S. engagement as well as U.S. arms. And the military loves it. And there is an incredible push to get a war going with Russia in the next week and a half. And you watch the confirmation hearing with Tillerson, you know, this Exxon, you know, corporate stooge who's supposed to become the Secretary of State. And he says, well, nobody expected that Russia would go in and seize Crimea and take it by force and violence. You know, nobody could have possibly predicted. So there's nothing that could have been done better there, you know, as if, you know, facilitating a coup in Kiev just didn't exist. And what would he have done? This is Ben Cardin, Democratic senator, demanding, well, what should we have done? And Joe sent every troop possible to the border of Russia. You know, that's Tillerson's answer. This is the new regime coming in. And the people who are afraid that peace with Russia might break out on January 21st are intent on getting, you know, a war going with Russia between now and then. A brave woman was just thrown out for saying that Exxon helped, you know, create Hurricane Sandy, which destroyed her house. And the next words out of Tillerson's mouth, as if nothing happened, were, you know, our beloved troops' sacred duty in these wars, you know, is not to be questioned. I mean, it's madness from both sides, and the two parties think they're opposing each other, and they're both just trying to outdo each other with military madness.
Yeah, no, for sure. Absolutely. I mean, it really is shocking that, you know, that you got the CEO of Exxon and the so-called Democrats who are for climate change seem to only be able to really talk about Russia. And I mean, it seems to me, David, as well, just to stay on this point, is, you know, Obama said in terms of in the early days before he was elected that he opposes quote-unquote dumb wars. But I thought beyond like whatever his record is with individual wars, I mean, the more important thing to me is the fact that he did almost nothing to curb the sort of institutional military-industrial complex. So even if he had opposed like all the wars that, you know, you and I are against, he still could have left office and the whole thing could have bounced back and been in exactly the same place as it was before. And there's no real acknowledgement of that sort of institutional role war and militarism plays in America.
Well, he promised to expand the military, and he did so. And the Pentagon got more money under Obama than any of the previous presidents. And he expanded the use of special ops, and he created this form of warfare known as drone murders that, you know, is going to be handed on to not just to the next presidents, but to ISIS and China and others who are now engaging in it. This is a president who made it now a policy choice in the hands of a single individual whether to go with war, who took the country to war without bothering to go tell Congress any lies, just wrote Congress out and went to wars, bombed eight countries proudly and bragged about it. And, you know, to have people coming into committee hearings yelling, no Trump, no KKK, no fascist USA, you know, it's a very reasonable demand that not a single senator is being paid to make, and nobody in the White House is making, President Obama's good riddance speech in Chicago notwithstanding. This has been 8 years of expanded militarism and expanded power and the legalization of torture and lawless imprisonment and warrantless spying and all of these symptoms of militarism that the, you know, the civil liberties groups try to oppose while supporting militarism. ACLU and CARE both last week arguing that the war on Iraq was to protect the Bill of Rights. You know, these are groups that go after all the symptoms of the wars and not only won't touch the wars but promote it. So, you know, there is not an anti-war party. I mean, why does the CIA think that anybody watches RT? Why such moaning and groaning over Americans watching RT? Well, there's not a single voice that wants to abolish war permitted on U.S. airwaves. There just isn't. Or you know, similarly on any number of other topics.
No, that's very true. You know, I once got invited on Headline News, right during the controversy of whether Obama was going to go to Syria or not. And they're like, yeah, we're going to do this whole interview on our morning show. It's going to be like 10 minutes, blah, blah, blah. And they asked me one question. I gave like a very anti-war answer. This is like maybe 45 seconds. And as soon as I was done, they were like, and we're going to go to commercial, cut it off. And we're like, hey, thanks for coming in. We'll call you again. Never called me again. I mean, I
share your experience. Yeah, I've had the same thing.
I'm telling you, and especially on Headline News, too, where it's like they're talking about like baking when they come back from the break. I mean, like it's not as
I would say it's even a little bit worse than just that, because with wars like Iraq and Afghanistan, you're right that there's no anti-war voices that are, for the most part, permitted on mainstream airwaves. But when it comes to like the wars of the present, like the more recent wars, like what we've done in Syria and what we did in the Ukraine before Russia took Crimea, you know, there are still these topics that are untouchable or you're not supposed to talk about or that are still controversial, even in progressive media spaces and some independent media spaces. And it's really frustrating. Like on the issue of Syria, I mean, I can speak from personal experience. It's like on that issue, voices who are against like what the U.S. has done in Syria don't get to have space at all, or else you're just like pro-dictator. And that's what's been done with Russia too, is people who are now like against, you know, escalating tensions with Russia are suddenly, you know, like there are certain voices and certain viewpoints that aren't permitted because it's like pro-Putin now in certain like spaces on the left. Like I find it really, really disturbing how deep it goes, the sort of self-censorship and people just kind of falling for U.S. propaganda and they don't even realize it.
Right, right. Well, I mean, I think that's a very good point, and you certainly have been at the tip of the spear of that as it concerns Syria. I mean, all you tried to do was just go somewhere, report there, and report what you reported on. And one thing I thought was interesting is I saw people criticizing you for once having a different position, and I'm just like, well, wait a second, though. Isn't this exactly what you want people to do? Like, say what you think based on the facts, and when you learn new facts, you potentially have a different position if it contradicts. I mean, that just seems like basic, like what they tell you in fourth grade to do when you go through basic logic.
Right. No, totally. There's a certain level of like, I don't know what it is. It's just this kind of purity politics that I feel like really does a lot of damage on the very, very tiny left that we have, if you can even call it a left. And so it concerns me because now you've got, you know, like what's happening to RT right now. There's people who I think are smart and who generally like I think are on the right side of things who either go silent or join in on like the vilification of RT in a way that is just stupid. Like, are you really saying that RT, like that, like we should all boycott RT? Like there's these like soft boycotts of RT just because it's like the, you know, like the Russian state channels. I mean, I don't see people boycotting the BBC. And like you mentioned, David, you know, I'm not saying RT is perfect, but the reason, again, people watch it and even go on it is because there are voices that are allowed on it because it's a channel. That's what happens even with U.S. channels abroad that are like funded by the U.S. government, is you get voices that are more critical of the governments in those countries. And that's what you get with RT. And so it's just another media outlet. I think this vilification is really out of control. The anti-Russia sentiment is really, really out of control. And it's got some smart people saying some really dumb things.
Yeah. I want to stick on this point because I think this is super relevant to me, is when you look at that quote unquote intelligence report and the things they picked out that were like showing RT was nefarious, it was all reporting on progressive activity, which anyone who watches RT knows. I mean, why didn't they say, well, when Ron Paul came on there, one of the million times he's been on there, and talked about auditing the Fed and you can't believe in the Fed, like, wasn't he trying to destabilize the U.S. money supply and undermine people's confidence in the Central Bank of America? I mean, you could have spent any number of things like that out there. I mean, by the way, I think the Republicans are going to pass and audit the Fed bill relatively soon. But like, they don't mention any of that, but it's all Occupy Wall Street, police brutality, election machines. So it almost seemed like the report was doubling down as like a hit on progressive political ideas.
Yeah, and this so-called, you know, report from the so-called intelligence, so-called community with their multi-billion dollar brains got basic facts wrong, got, you know, said old shows were new, got the personalities wrong, screwed up the dates because they don't know some parts of the world put the date the day before the month, you know, and we're supposed to take on absolute faith what they tell us that's not publicly available, you know, but to criticize RT because people watch it, because it reports on fracking or on Occupy or shows third-party candidates, that's a criticism of the U.S. media. If the U.S. media would report honestly on fracking or Occupy, or if you could read a New York Times article that didn't say that a report like that one was totally damning and then many paragraphs later explain that it didn't have a shred of evidence in it, you know, if U.S. media would supply the need, people wouldn't be going to watch RT. RT is far from perfect. When I criticize Russia on RT, if it's not live, they tend to cut that out. But they invite me back on, you know.
Right.
When I criticize the United States on U.S. media, I'm never heard from again, you know. So there's this yes, you should always get your media from, you know, outside of whatever country you're trying to learn about. But, you know, in my experience, RT is more accepting of my criticism of Russia than the U.S. is of my criticism of the U.S. military.
Yeah. No, I think that's 100% true. I mean, for sure. And it may make sense in terms for them to even be able to exist as a media property. But, I mean, the level of and the lack of – really, I mean, that's one other thing, too, about the U.S. media is even, like, the people they bring on sometimes, like, who are these people and where do they find them? But, I mean, I think it's extraordinarily unbelievable the way that this is happening, the way it's happening in terms of who it's affecting, more so where, like, all of a sudden Julian Assange is on Sean Hannity and, you know, whatever. That is what it is. But, I mean, it's just like this is a guy who was saying assassinate Julian Assange, you know, 2 weeks before or whatever when it comes out. So, I mean, it really does seem like we are, you know, through the looking glass on this one for sure. But either way, we are going to have to leave it there for now. Obviously, quite a bit on all of these topics, and we will continue to come back. I'm sure you'll hear from David Swanson and Rania Kalik again on this show. But again, we are out of time here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. See you next time.
By any means necessary.